everybody. Thank you for joining us for our annual telecom and media conference. Lots going on in Canadian telecom space this year, with leading the way has been Rogers, who's been very busy. So we're thrilled to kick off our conference this year with the CEO and CFO of Rogers Communications. So Joe Natale and Tony Staffieri, thanks very much for joining us this morning, guys.
Morning, Vince. Thanks for having us at the top of the hour.
Good morning.
So let's just kick it off with a general question in case there's any updates you want to provide people. I mean, you obviously got the favorable shareholder vote on the Shaw front last week. You got court approval yesterday. Anything new? And you gave the preferred share redemption notice as well. Anything you want to provide investors with in terms of update on the time frame or the process of the takeover?
Thanks, Vince. First of all, obviously, we're very delighted with the degree of support we got, overwhelming support from shareholders and the courts as well. And we're, you know, now working through the various regulatory approvals with the Competition Bureau, the CRTC, and ISED. We're in the early stages of that. We don't anticipate, you know, any major obstacles there from what we discussed last time. We still see this transpiring in the first half of 2022, and the team is well prepared, and we've got, you know, a great set of facts and economic data to support our position on the deal as a whole.
And anything on the that was sort of on the approval and time frame, anything on the integration plans and synergy targets? Are you able to get in and do any more work since March, or do you sort of have to wait until the deal closes?
It's a bit in between. We still operate very much as two separate companies. And if you look back to the plan of arrangement, there was a very specific and clear outline as to how we would interface. We've set up a integration governance structure between ourselves and Shaw. We meet on a regular basis. We've dedicated a team of people full-time to work on the integration across a whole number of work streams. You know, bear in mind, there are a lot of people inside of our organization who've been through some big integrations, some big mergers over the years. So we've got a good base of talent as to what's required to get this done. Our goal is pretty straightforward, and that is to work over the course of the next many months. So we have a very detailed playbook and integration plan across every aspect of the business. So the minute we get regulatory approval, we hit the ground running. And bear in mind that you know, the vast majority of our organization, 99.9% of the company, is focused on the business. And the whole idea was to create a team of people devoted to the integration, led by the executive team, of course, and, you know, ready to kind of get going on every aspect of the synergies, from revenue to CapEx to OpEx.
Excellent. So let's turn back to that 99% and the focus on the core business. 5G has been a big push for you guys. It's a big push for most telcos, but you guys seem to have been out of the gates a bit faster than some of your peers in Canada. Can you give us some updates in terms of how many customers are actually using 5G devices today, and what type of usage and ARPU profile you might see from that cohort of customers?
Well, it's still early days to really, you know, look at 5G adoption in a broad way as a whole, but well, we were very clear and specific that we wanted to lead the market in this area. Bear in mind, we've got 2.6 million customers on Infinite plans. Every one of those customers has our 5G network available to them. And at last count, we are covering 173 cities, roughly 600 communities as a whole. You know, more to come on that front. We just got ranked having the highest amount of time on 5G. And this is still early days. We're really, of course, waiting for the next spectrum auction. We'll continue to kind of invest in coverage and capacity on 5G. Our goal is very simply, as the economy opens up, as mobility becomes an even more important part of people's day-to-day lives, as restrictions and lockdowns come to conclusion, We think there's going to be a surge in appetite for mobility services, and 5G will be front and center in that equation, especially as new handsets show up in the marketplace.
Okay. That's kind of the consumer side, Joe. How about on the enterprise and Internet of Things side? You have a lot of partnerships and ventures underway with the likes of UBC and Waterloo and Amazon Web Services, I think some mining companies as well. What are your latest thoughts on how material those enterprise, you know, IoT applications could be in the future, and your latest thoughts on how soon we might actually start to see some noticeable revenue from those new services?
I'm very excited. I think, you know, over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, this will become the core of the B2B business as a whole. There won't be an application or a network opportunity that doesn't involve 5G in some way, shape, or form. Just like, you know, a generation ago, you know, we were putting in, you know, wireline, high-capacity, high-speed wireline networks that just became the mainstay of organizations like the very connection that we're on today, for example. I think it'll be that pervasive as this ramps up. We're all placing different bets on it. Our view is a very simple one, is that our network becomes the treasure or the capability that we will offer to various applications and various partners as a whole. There'll be a whole bunch of new currencies in that network. Currencies won't just be, you know, volume of data, but there'll be currencies around latency, currencies around specific functionality for an application. But one of the big bets we're placing down is on private networks, just to begin with private LTE networks, which will make their way into private 5G networks. We launched the first one of those just in March of this year. And the idea is to give a slice of our network or a piece of our network to a particular organization so they can use it as a sort of capability that is just for them, without having to replicate, you know, infrastructure for their needs in that facility or that mine, to your question, Vince, or that manufacturing plant, et cetera. I think this sort of whole private network business will be a big part of it. Then you add to that a number of industry vertical areas of focus. We think the first ones for us will include transportation, asset management, smart cities, and we're doing work in all of those right now. We struck partnerships with RealmB, for example. We struck partnerships with Fleet Complete and a few other organizations. And then, as you mentioned, we've created these innovation R&D groups at the University of British Columbia, University of Calgary, and the University of Waterloo. And the idea there is to get researchers together with business, together with the startup community, and find ideas and applications that we can give life to. And help to stimulate the confidence in these ideas, but also have to stimulate the commercial scaling of the ideas as this happens. So, you know, I'm quite excited about it. This will be evolutionary as it does take place, and we're going to be in the center of it. The opportunity for us as, you know, the largest wireless carrier, and the opportunity for us in terms of net new growth into the enterprise space, is critical to making sure that we do have a great set of capabilities on this front.
And will we see revenues like in 2022, or is it, should we think more 23, 24 before it starts to make any noticeable impact on the reported financials we see?
Well, I mean, we're seeing revenues right now, but it's not material at this stage. I would say it'll be 23, 24 before it's sort of something we would call out specifically. We'll continue to given investors, you know, insights and a heads up to key projects that are sort of the vanguard of what we're up to. But we think, you know, there's a material opportunity in our business in the next few years.
And philosophically, maybe when you think about 5G, Joe, that most telcos seem to be thinking of it as network as a service. And you may do private networks, but you won't actually be providing all of the software and applications. You'll leave that to the corporate entity to do, or a third-party technology company. At least one of your competitors thinks a bit differently and seems to want to become a software and application company. Where does Rogers see itself in that? Are you just an aggregator of other people's apps, or will you actually start investing in software to provide full end-to-end managed services at some point as well?
Well, our overall view is it's a managed services business. And at the very least, it's a managed network service opportunity or capability. At the very best, up that stack, we will have partnerships with globally relevant software organizations that may have started in Canada, may have started somewhere else, that we believe has, you know, best in breed or best in class solution for a particular application, or maybe a couple of them in the specific space as a whole. We may take some sort of investment in some of these companies if we believe that they're really going to help drive growth and be a part of it. But, you know, I've been down the road before looking at starting, you know, application or software businesses in Canada, and you quickly kind of get to a point where you realize you need global scale and global distribution. And you end up, you know, selling that asset to someone else who can do exactly that. My view is I'd rather form the right partnerships with people that have that capability. You know, Fleet Complete's a good example. Fleet Complete is a fleet management, asset management business. It started in Canada and now has global scale and capability in a number of countries across the world. And forming deep partnerships with organizations like that, where we get, you know, a piece of a pie, where we are part of the managed service offering that creates the lifetime value and the stickiness for the enterprise customer, is where we'd like to be. I think the key is to pick certain verticals or horizontals that matter in Canada, because some of them are of scale in Canada and some of them really are too small to have a focused business on in Canada. And that's why we've picked, you know, asset tracking, transportation, smart cities, mining and resources as sort of the key areas of focus. We think those are substantial in nature and will help us drive the train in terms of revenue growth.
Excellent. So obviously to make all of these services and networks work, you have to have, you know, spectrum. Rogers has some pretty enviable holdings in low and mid-band spectrum. You don't own any millimeter wave spectrum at this point, which nobody in Canada owns. Lots of debate in the U.S. as to whether, you know, the millimeter wave is really worth what was paid for it and how integral it will be. What's your thoughts? Do you have enough low and mid-band spectrum? Maybe you can avoid the densification of cell sites that are needed for millimeter wave, or at least push that off for 10 years or more, or is millimeter wave in more than near-term thinking for you?
Well, first of all, we're really happy with the spectrum position we have already. And the mid-band spectrum that we have and, you know, what's to follow in the upcoming 3,500, 3,800 auctions, and we'll see how those shake out, will give us a lot of opportunity and capability, especially as it relates to densification, to your question, Vince. Millimeter wave has its application. It's a great spectrum band for fixed multi-point communications, especially in urban settings. So there's a use and a purpose for it. It'll be used for infill in certain urban settings, in building coverage, or, you know, particular kind of low geographical propagation coverage where you need high speed. So there's a use and a purpose for it. And I think the way you look at it is, you know, each of the spectrum bands, low, medium, and high frequency, millimeter wave for that matter, has an opportunity to create network capability, and they'll be used to that specific capability. It's when you try to substitute one for the other that the economics start to break down, right? You need low frequency spectrum for far-reaching geographic propagation, and hence the position we took around 600, where we have about 80% of the 600 megahertz spectrum available to us. The mid-frequency spectrum will do a lot more in terms of speed and capacity over a narrow area. And then as we look at applications in key cities, we may look at millimeter wave. I mean, there's no question that some applications will require millimeter wave, but it'll be on a bespoke application basis as opposed to one of them is going to win over the other.
Okay. Segue a bit into your cable business. Bit of a transitory question is on the regulatory front. We had the MVNO decision. I mean, in my perspective, it was a pretty balanced, favorable decision for incumbents, at least upholding the facilities-based philosophy. So feel free to comment on that if you want. It's already been talked about, I think, enough in the past, but I won't stop you if you want to give some comment on it. But the question is, the TPIA decision, you know, third-party internet access wholesale rates for people on the line, seems like it's coming out this week. Finally, going to hear what the final rates are from the CRTC. Do you have any thoughts on what they might do on that file? And any, am I too optimistic to think they may think if facilities-based works in wireless and that's such the foundation of the regulatory philosophy, why not consider something closer to that in the fixed line as well, as opposed to letting people resell forever with no obligation to build their own network? So any comments on MVNO and then the upcoming TPIA decision would be great.
Yeah, thanks, Vince. First of all, I'd say the MVNO decision, above all else, provides certainty. And certainty is a thing that we've been after as an industry. And certainty that reinforces the importance of infrastructure investment and infrastructure investment-based competition. It's what has got us to this great point. You know, Canada has, as we've talked about many times, you know, some of the very best networks in the world, ranked number one or number two in the world. It's because of this regulatory policy that we stand in that place with that trophy, especially when you consider the geographic expanse of Canada and the low population density. It's a bit of a miracle that we got to that place, but it's only because of the regulatory environment that reinforced the need to build to the far corners of Canada. I think one thing that COVID has taught us more than ever is that, you know, high-speed wireline infrastructure matters too in a big way. We have 2 million homes in Canada that don't have access to high-speed internet. And I don't know what's going to come out with the decision this week, but I really hope it reinforces the need for investment, in making sure that every Canadian gets connected. It's not a very complicated puzzle. And that is the harder the economics on, you know, the edge of urban and suburban Canada, the more difficult it is for anyone to build to those places. And if you have to get to a place where you have to resell your network at a loss the minute that you build the network, you know, it doesn't take a lot of thinking to say, you know what, why would we do that? Now, to be fair, there are a number of broadband funds that will help to kind of bridge some of those economics. That's great. But we're hoping that the decision this week helps to reinforce infrastructure mindset around wireline networks, which have become, you know, ever critically important for a new virtual world that has been accelerated through COVID, whether it's, you know, working, learning, or this conference for that matter. It's all happening more virtually. And as a result, the investment thesis is even more critical.
And I have a question from the audience on cable as well. It's, how do you compete with the big aggressive fiber to the home rollouts that are going on? How will you maintain your market share, and how does coax hold up versus fiber?
Tony's here with me. Give him a chance to kind of jump into the conversation, but we've got a very clear path on that point, Vince. We think there's a lot of future and roadmap in DOCSIS. And we're going to continue to kind of, you know, driving on that front as well. Where it makes sense, we're putting in fiber and GPON. We've been doing that in Greenfield for years. So I'll pause there and give Tony a chance to jump in on this topic. Tony?
Sure. Thanks, Joe. To lead off with, we've been competing with one form of either fiber to the node and fiber to the home for well over 10 years. And we're quite pleased with the momentum that our cable business has gained over the years, and in particular over the last few quarters. You know, in the last quarter, we saw revenue growth of 5% on the back of, despite the pandemic, some, I think, pretty solid numbers in terms of, you know, internet net adds of 14,000 higher than the year before, and our Ignite TV net adds 58,000 higher than the year before. So we have a lot of confidence in the execution in our cable business. And as Joe said, product superiority is more and more important. And today we offer 1 gig across our entire footprint, and very imminent it'll be 1.5 gigs. And the DOCSIS roadmap is extremely compelling as you see download and upload speeds continuing to increase. Importantly, well ahead of where market demand sits today. So if you look at the actual number of customers that are at 1 gig for us, it continues to be less than 10%. And so I think it's important to highlight the competitiveness of our network. You know, the last mile of coax is not only going to deliver at speeds ahead of market demand, but importantly, on a very cost-effective basis. And so we feel quite comfortable with the technology. If we're to look at the revenue increase and what's been contributing to it over the last little while, Q1, we had 5% increase in revenue, really made up of the two parts. We're seeing good increase in average revenue per customer or per account. And that's really made up of two things. One, the customer up-tiering, either to Ignite TV and or to higher internet speeds. And it's that natural inertia that's helping move ARPA up. We did have a price increase back in October, and that contributed a portion of the ARPA help as well. And then the second piece is really footprint expansion. Our market continues to grow in roughly the 1-2% range during the pandemic. So a bit of a slowdown in construction and move-ins, but slowly picking up as the pandemic moves on. And so when you put that footprint expansion combined with, you know, what we're seeing in ARPA, we're quite confident with sustainability of our cable financials and revenue in particular.
Now, you mentioned the rate increases, Tony. I mean, my perception has been not just yourselves, but most of the wireline players in Canada have announced rate increases almost every year for the past several years, but we don't see it translate into revenue growth as much as we might expect. It always seems to be promotional discounting off of those sort of base rate cards that eats up a lot of the rate increase. So the 5% revenue growth you put up was really strong in my mind, and shows that more of that rate increase plus the up-tiering is starting to fall through to the actual reported revenue. I'm wondering, is there some credit here to be given to discipline by your competitors, your main competitor, to be clear? It seems like 18 months ago, it was just a heated battle between yourselves and Bell and tons of promotional skirmishes, and we weren't seeing anywhere near this type of revenue growth in your cable business. Have things calmed down? And if so, do you think it's sustainable?
There's probably two factors that I point to contributing to what we're seeing is fairer pricing in the marketplace. And one is we've gotten a lot better at promotional discounting. And so when customers came on a 6-month, 12-month, or even 2-year discount, it was really hard for the customer to move up to market rate pricing. They have forgotten, for the most part, they were on a promotion. And so all of a sudden, what they thought was market pricing was an interim promotional, and it was a bad experience for everyone. And so we got a lot better at managing those promotional periods to much shorter periods of time. And when customers come off, doing a better job of getting them to market rate pricing and making sure they expected that. You know, from our end, we've gotten a lot better at that. And then the second thing is, I think the market realizes that with us as an industry getting better at service and getting installations a lot more efficiently and getting a customer, you know, in our case, up and running within 4 hours with self-install, you know, the ease of switching is higher than it's ever been. And so I think with that, I think there's a realization on our part that promotional discounting over a long period of time may not win the hearts of the customer in terms of loyalty. And somewhat related to that, we think more than ever the customers really need reliability on the internet during these times. And so price becomes a secondary factor. And so while you always have promotions in and out of market, our sense is right now the customer is looking for the superior product.
Good stuff. I want to talk about business telecom within cable a bit as well. We don't hear much about that from Rogers. I know in the past, I think it's been admitted by Rogers management that you're a bit behind some of your peers in terms of gains in the SMB space and overall market share in biz telecom. Are you making strides there? I know Dean Prevost has been running that business now for a while for you. Is there more going on behind the scenes that we're just not hearing about? And can you give us any sense of the trajectory there?
Sure, Vince. If you were to look inside our business, you would see that our wireline / cable fiber B2B business is the fastest growing part of Rogers. Inside, some of those cable results are just that. We're seeing high single digit, low double digit growth in that area, just because we're focused on it for the first time, I think, in years. And we've got a suite of products that really is appealing, leveraging the cable footprint, leveraging the capability of cable, but putting in some of the managed service aspects and capability that businesses are looking for, small and medium businesses for that matter. So it'll continue to be a growth opportunity for the Rogers organization. As Rogers and Shaw comes together, there are a series of synergies on that front that we're quite excited about. One is Shaw has certainly done a very good job of growing their SMB capability in Western Canada with their suite of product offerings, and they've driven greater penetration of market share. I think we can leverage and bootstrap some of that product capability in Central and Eastern Canada, as an example. But then the other big prize is the enterprise space. The enterprise space in Canada is worth $3 to $5 billion in terms of revenue, and it's a de facto monopoly, probably the last standing monopoly in the industry as a whole in the telco world. We just have not had the national footprint to make the economics work. When you've got, over half your network off net and you have to deal with off net economics in terms of leasing access points or leasing fiber, et cetera, to make it work, you kind of often cut yourself out of these large enterprise deals. So we think there is a material opportunity for us as a combined company to go after that space. We'll effectively have a very far-reaching wireline network in, every province of the country except Quebec. And in Quebec, we've got a decent fiber footprint already. So I think it'll be a game changer for us on that front as well. And we're quite excited about both SMB and enterprise.
Opportunities you think to partner with Quebec or Videotron on true national enterprise scale?
I think it'll be sort of opportunity specific. If there's an opportunity that has a deep footprint need in Quebec, then we'll certainly look for the right partner in Quebec around that. I think no matter who you are in Canada to serve the enterprise space, there's always a part of the country where you end up leasing or trading facilities. It's just making that a minor piece of the equation versus a major piece of the equation that fundamentally shifts the economics in our favor.
Okay. Shift to the cost side. There's been some impressive cost reduction and cost management, not just during the pandemic, but even the trends prior to. But in the past few quarters, these substantial cost reductions we've seen in both the cable and the wireless side, Tony, have you been able to identify at this point now how much of it is just pandemic related and how much of it might come back, things like retail stores, travel and entertainment, maybe a bit of return to physical office space? Can you segregate that a bit better for us these days, or is it still too early to figure out what's transitory and what's permanent?
Yeah, as you say, Vince, our focus has been on margin expansion over the last little while. So irrespective of, the revenue profile that the pandemic throws at us, we have a cost structure that continues to deliver on EBITDA and margin improvements. We do have a good line of sight as to what will pick up and what is sustainable. We've been focused on sort of more of the structural pieces of it that I'll talk to in a moment. But there are things that will come back. In the cable side of things, very small in terms of what comes back. Selling costs is clearly one, as you think about door-to-door and some of those channels. That'll certainly pick up. And similarly on the wireless side, as stores reopen and we continue to staff them, we'll see a pickup in costs. And for the first little while, it'll be a bit disproportionate in that, when you open a store, there's a certain amount of staffing and other costs you have in running the store, notwithstanding, how many people may show up at the stores or at the mall. So, there are going to be those costs, but notwithstanding that, we think the amount of structural reductions we've made should continue to offset that on the whole as you look at it over several quarters. So we're feeling good about the margin expansion on the cable side specifically. One of our biggest costs are content costs, and trying to variabilize those costs has been a focus for us. The move to digital can't underestimate the cost savings that have resulted from that in terms of everything from ordering costs, fulfillment, to installation. And so we're quite pleased and expect to see continued solid margins over the coming quarters, both in terms of absolute percentages and particularly on the cable side, continue year-on-year improvements.
Vince, I think you're on mute.
Yeah, thank you very much. Sorry, I was getting a bit of feedback from Tony, so I keep going on mute. Tony, I was just saying on the CapEx side in cable as well, I think it's a bit unfortunate for you guys that you said for years that you accelerated your node splitting and we'd see the benefit of that in CapEx coming down. We've seen CapEx come down eventually, but the pandemic hit at the same time. So I think some people think it's just pandemic benefits versus your long-term plan that you had already articulated. So can you talk through that a bit more? Have there been some sort of splitting or other network projects that had to get postponed because of the pandemic? Is that really a big part of the CapEx reduction in cable, or is it all just sort of the long-term plan and you can stay at 20-22% of revenue or even go lower even once we're fully reopened as an economy?
I'll start with where we're at and what we expect in terms of capital intensity for cable. As you said, we have been trending to the 20-22%, which had been our target. And we continue to expect a trend in that range. In any particular quarter, you may see us go to 23%, depending on the timing of a particular build project. But we do see it as sustainable, and it's really made up of two parts. When you look at the reduction, and one is real efficiency savings. I mentioned self-install. Over 90% of our home installations are now self-install, and that's huge savings, as one example. We've also quite a bit of progress on the procurement side in terms of hardware, and we like where that's going. And that's offset with increased investment, actually, in terms of network, whether it's node splitting, whether it's expansion of the footprint. Some of that has slowed down, but behind the scenes, there's a lot more investment into core network sustainability, reliability, and capacity than there has been in the past.
About 10 minutes left. We haven't talked too much about just the current wireless business. We talked a bit about 5G in the future. Any updates you want to provide now that we're sort of mid Q2 on the sort of trends of the pandemic impacts to subscriber growth, as well as sort of roaming and other factors that have been negatively impacted?
Why don't I start, and then Tony, you can kick in as well. One thing we're seeing is that there's a lot of pent-up demand out there, and as you look at there's a period when stores were more open in the sort of March timeframe, and we saw some of that pent-up demand. We also looked at some of the, I think MasterCard did a survey recently and said, post-pandemic or pandemic recovery, what are your priorities in terms of where you spend your money? And of course, travel, et cetera, was on the list, but getting a new cell phone was right up there in the top few. So we think there is a lot of pent-up demand. We think as restrictions lift, we'll see those volumes continue to grow. We saw good volume growth as an industry in Q1. We think that'll continue into the rest of the year. And, you know, as we kind of get even better at flexing in and out of stores open, stores restricted, stores closed, what we're learning is that we can work our way through that dynamic, you know, as things go on. But, you know, and that's with people largely staying at home or not traveling as much. We're not moving around as much. I think mobility will be an even more important and critical tool for people that will drive the adoption. You know, penetration rates in Canada are still far below the U.S., and we see that, you know, as an opportunity. You know, immigration has pretty much been halted and, you know, or so seriously curtailed. And as immigration resumes and, you know, students come into the country from other countries, people come to Canada on work visas, we'll see a lot of that growth come to the market as a whole. And of course, the roaming question is a big one. We're looking very carefully at what's happening in different parts of the world and in countries like Israel, et cetera, that are further ahead on the vaccination front and the kind of travel that's being, you know, opened up, you know, along the way. So at some point, both business and consumer travel, we believe, will resume. It'll be on an incremental curve at first, but we'll resume because there's a pent-up demand, I believe, for both. It's interesting to hear the commentary out of some of the big banks on Wall Street say, you know what, we're tired of Zoom calls. It's time to get out there and meet our customers. And I think there's a sort of a sentiment that is in that zone, which we'll see an acceleration of that when it does become safe to do so. I'll pause there and throw it to Tony.
Yeah, just to pick up on that, Joe, put some numbers around it. You know, postpaid net ad growth in the first quarter for the industry was 70%. We're sort of honing in on closing the second quarter, you know, two-thirds of the way through. Our sense is the market continued to grow, if not at that pace, even more in the second quarter. Keep in mind, last year, Q2 was really the first quarter of the pandemic shutdown. And so we really are, you know, going from not quite a standstill last year, but, you know, significant reduction of volumes. And so we are seeing that volume come through. And we're seeing that volume come through at healthy ARPU rates as well. When we look at the mix in terms of Flanker, as well as on the Rogers brand, the Unlimited, both continue to do well in terms of volume. And so a good balance mixed of ARPU coming with that volume.
So trending perhaps a bit better than the outlook you gave us on the first quarter call, Tony, or you still think that's reasonable?
No, I think on the first quarter call, what you heard us talk about ARPU being roughly flat sequentially, and that's still the case, maybe just a bit better. You know, keep in mind, it takes a while for incoming ARPU to have sufficient volume to sort of lift the average base. And so you'll see that improvement in subsequent quarters. So the guidance we provided or have provided for the second quarter, we continue to have a high degree of confidence around.
Okay. In terms of the inbound ARPU being strong, it may answer this question, but let me ask it anyway. When we came out of the first lockdowns last, you know, summer, in the August timeframe, it seemed like there was a tremendous rush to aggressive promotions across the wireless industry. Do you think that could happen, or is it starting to happen again this time, or do you think there were some lessons learned that that's a bit of a race to the bottom? And yes, stores are open, but we don't want to load customers at any price. We still have to look for quality loading.
I certainly can't speak for all of our peers, but I would say from our perspective, you know, there was a rush in, and somehow we had maybe a belief that we were coming out of COVID and, you know, we were just going to ramp back to normalcy. And then we saw, of course, second wave and then third wave. I think we're a lot smarter as an industry in terms of understanding, you know, that you know, today's promotions, today's ideas are you'll have to live with in terms of ARPU impact for years to come, and what they do to your base is especially important. because it's not just the promotion in the window, it's the person calling in and saying, why can't I get that deal? That has the biggest sort of impact on ARPU as a whole. So I think that'll temper it a bit. I think we've gotten a lot more sanguine around, you know, what COVID looks like and the trajectory coming out of it. I think, you know, it wasn't long ago, but this time last year, we were thinking, okay, a few more months of this and we're coming out of it. I mean, that sounds so naive at this point, right? But, you know, the entire world believed that. Now we've gotten a lot more educated as we learn more about what it all means and how it might come back. Add to that some of the chip shortages that are out there and the like, and we feel comfortable with our inventory, but I think at the end of the day, people are going to be a lot more thoughtful around how they approach the summer selling season. And then in the fall, we'll get into, will there be a new iPhone, not be a new iPhone? That'll drive a piece of sentiment. But those are the regular cycles events that are going on, right? The important thing is, I think, you know, but as it relates to equipment subsidy, we seem to have found a new rhythm in Canada as a whole. Now, you know, gone are the days of discounting the $1,000 smartphone completely. And, you know, we're realizing that as smartphones become more expensive, we actually create a problem with our customers by not being explicit around the cost of the phone and how it's being amortized in terms of their bill, et cetera. And we found that, you know, it's actually improved customer retention, improved customer satisfaction by putting the cost of the phone on the bill, being very explicit about it. And financing it in and of itself, right? And I think that's good for us and good for the industry. And it shows up in equipment margin and shows up in many parts of the business, frankly.
Excellent. A question from the audience again on something you touched on, Tony, was the retail stores coming back and the costs to get them ramped up again. But is there an opportunity to perhaps come out of the pandemic with a lower retail store footprint than you had before, given how much the industry's learned about digital and online sales, or do you expect to go back to the same number of stores eventually?
I think if we think about channel migration, it's going to be important that, in our view, we'd be very measured about disinvesting in any particular channel. I think what we want to do, especially in the near term, is be flexible for the way the market wants to move. Clearly during the pandemic, digital has taken priority and we think that's great. What we are seeing when things open up is more of an omni-channel approach by the customer where some of it's online, followed up by in-store or vice versa. And so that capability is going to be important. We invested a lot in our distribution franchise over the last 30 years and it's the leading franchise in the industry. In terms of retail points of distribution effectiveness. And so before we disinvest, we want to make sure that the data is clear, that that's what the customer wants.
The key, I think, Vince, is to meet the customer where they want to be. We launched two capabilities during the pandemic that have really taken root. One is Pro on the Go. I guess we launched just before the pandemic. We ramped it during the pandemic. Pro on the Go, where the phone gets delivered to you and the qualified technician will help you set it up, you know, transfer your data, et cetera, et cetera. And the other one is curbside pickup, where you can order online and then, you know, someone will bring it out to your car. And these are all sort of modalities that have taken great root in the middle of COVID. I think those will persist. But, you know, the store, especially the mall store, or the high traffic main street store, I think will continue to be an important fixture in our business. You know, wireless especially is a shopper category. People do get up and say, you know what, I want to go see the new phone, whatever the phone might be. And they'll march through a mall or march through Main Street and kind of take a look at it. If you're not there, you're not going to trap or intercept that traffic. So, you know, of course we will augment it with digital precision marketing and all the things I just talked about. But as to Tony's point, they'll be operating in an omni-channel capability. And if anything, we'll use it to shape channel mix because not all channels are created equal, right? You know, our own channels are the most efficient. As soon as we have to share a piece of the pie with a third party, of course, the economics of that particular sale or that particular transaction change. So we have a great opportunity to change channel economics by shaping the mix through these, you know, multimodal experiences that I just described.
Excellent. Well, we've run out of time. I will leave it there. And thank you very much, Joe and Tony, for joining us to kick off our conference and sharing your updated insights and thoughts with us. Have a good day.
And before you go, Vince, one more thing. Go Leafs, go.
Thanks. Thanks for acknowledging my signage back there.
Thank you.
Take care.